Hello, and welcome to Crime Theories Off the Record, a podcast series where I explain my interpretation of criminological theories behind the why, when, and where people misbehave. This is your host, Karin.
Hello, everyone. Today, I will briefly introduce cultural criminology, but first, let's take a trip down the academic memory lane to the 90s. In the mid-1990s, cultural criminology developed in both the United States and in the United Kingdom, with writings having significant cross-national impacts. Its early theoretical orientation was based on the argument that crime and crime control cannot be understood apart from the domain of culture, whereas criminology has traditionally focused on issues like the structural facilitators of patterns of everyday crime, crimes are, in fact, cultural. According to this perspective, crimes are constructed from symbolic interactions among groups and people and are shaped by ongoing conflicts over their meaning and perceptions. According to American criminologist Jeff Ferrell, cultural criminology is built on the groundbreaking work of Cohen, 1971 and 1980, and Hepditch, 1979, and other British cultural theorists. It's focused on the meaning of crime and criminality in everyday life for criminals, politicians, criminal justice organizations, the media, and popular culture was contested, not agreed upon. Following this perspective, crime does not have the same meaning to those who want to control or prevent, study, and report it in the media, or who participate in it. The purpose of crime is instead the result of a complex process through which illicit subcultures, the mass media, political authorities, criminal justice professionals, and others contest the meaning of crime and criminality. Off the record, this isn't a new concept for us. As consumers of true crime and the media, we can see how crime does not have the same meaning to those who want to control or prevent, study, and report it in the media or who participate in it. It does not even have the same meaning across time as policies and laws change. Political debates about crime and crime control represented to the media often include dynamic examples and symbols of mayhem and threat to the public while simultaneously denigrating criminals. Criminals and criminal subcultures, however, may very likely give the same behavior an alternative meaning organized around elaborate conventions of appearance, vocabularies of motive, and stylized presentations of self. One result is that crime in the hands of the media can turn into politics as moral entrepreneurs launch campaigns of moral panic over crime and criminals. A key dimension of this model was the idea that traditional models of examining the effects of media on crime and subsequent crime, or the accuracy of the media in reporting criminality, were outdated. Now, Watson to my Sherlock, what was needed, it was argued, was a model that can account for a world so saturated with media technology and media images that distinctions between a crime and its mediated image are often lost. In this world, crime and media are linked by a looping effect in which crime and the image of it come back to one another, together constructing the reality of crime for participants and the public. Examples of media loops and spirals, it was argued, which are illustrative of this theoretical observation, are found in squad car cameras influencing everyday policing, in juries demanding evidence like what is presented in CSI-style television programs, in violence such as staged encounter of teenage females beating up another female that is recorded and posted on the web for profit, and in what is called, quote-unquote, underground fighting. Crime, criminal justice agencies such as the police, and the media are part of an ongoing feedback loop. We can see all this in all the true crime content we consume. Off the record, I am going to get on my soapbox for a little bit regarding true crime. And yes, sometimes I am guilty of consuming way too much true crime for my own good. True crime is inherently a form of media and entertainment. Generally, it has always been the target of criticism when the victims or victim family of the victim or victim's consent is disregarded or not obtained, as sometimes they get constantly re-victimized or portray the victim as one more of the victims and not for who they are or where. Though true crime does help to observe and understand culture and societal norms of when the criminal event or events happen, it sometimes comes with a human cost. And I don't mean just the life of the victim, but the family and the community it affects as well. The reality is that it is inhumane to sell a documentary, make a movie, or whatever regarding someone's most traumatic moment or last moments at the emotional expenses of a grieving family or person. Hence, you must be mindful of what type of true crime you promote and or consume. Now back to the theory. Cultural criminology critique the methods often used by conventional criminology and offer alternatives. Survey research and statistical analysis of survey research were, according to cultural criminologists, inadequate for understanding the interpretive dimensions, meaning representation and emotion, of crime. Now, conventional criminology methods reduce the behavior of offenders to soulless pieces of data that were then fitted into preset categories analyzed with cross-tabulations. Cultural criminology methods stress the human dynamics of surprise, ambiguity, and such things as anger, factors that are often ignored by conventional criminology as well as by the media. But before I fully jump into this, I would like to remind everyone that I am not an expert in every aspect of my field, but I have researched the topic. Cultural criminology was not without theoretical and methodological critiques, some of whom were particularly insightful. Its use of culture, its central concept, is illustrative. Put succinctly, cultural criminology was charged with using a definition of cultural base more on political rather than analytical motivations. One result was confusion about the meaning of culture and subculture. In Farrell's 1996 work about graffiti, for example, cultural generally refers to the state of or the mainstream and its followers. Although they are ideologically critiqued as boring, average, and one-dimensional, members of subcultures were celebrated with the minutiae of detail, depicting them both as somehow morally superior to and more creative than the mainstream. At the heart of O'Brien's specific critique of Farrell and cultural criminology, including Jung's efforts 1999 and 2003, to revitalize left realism was what O'Brien identified as a lack of understanding and engagement with the classic debates on the meaning of culture found in social anthropology. Off the record, though I did withdraw from anthropology, I can say that the result was a fundamental confusion about what culture represents concerning different levels of analysis and a collection of forced definitions intended to deal with the confusion on a case-by-case basis. Put differently, they were asking some questions, such as, where is culture in the work of cultural criminology if its ethnographic work makes no distinction between psychological, economic, political, and geographical forces that impinge on experiencing crime individually or the patterns of crime over time? Jumping to the early 2000s, Hull and Willow 2004 and Hull, Willow and Ankrum 2008, however, address some of these questions. They did so by creating a theoretical perspective that utilized, among others, Jack Lakin's 2006 Refashioned Freudian Psychiatry, Lack's 1979 work on narcissism, and Sysak's 2002-2006, multiple 2006 works actually, 2007 and 2008, Philosophy, Psychoanalysis, and Cultural Criticism, and Frank's 1997 Commentating on Hip Consumerism and the Profound Contradictions and Ironies of American Politics. A key to understand this take on cultural criminology is found in Hull and Winslow's observation that whereas cultural criminology had much promise for the analysis of crime and social disorder, it had thus far placed too much emphasis on its perspective being grounded firmly in the economic logic of advanced capitalism. They proposed instead an approach that puts crime, especially violence, within the context of increasing instrumentalism in consumer culture and the breakdown of the pseudo-pacification process. Pseudo-pacification process describes what Hull and Winslow saw as the weakening strength of contemporary culture to hold together the collective social solidarity that followed after the Enlightenment, and until recent decades, characterizes Western capitalistic societies. They argue that the civilizing impact of the Hobbesian social contract with government on the superego and diminishing anxiety, volatility, and violence had weakened considerably for some parts of our society. One result was that the acquisition of cultural commodities by brutal barbaric behavior was in fact an instrumental response to significantly heightened anxiety and insecurity. However, as Hull and Winslow 2004 emphasized, it was not the material aspects of consumer goods that provoked desire and ambition, but rather the social symbolism and power to provide identity and meaning in what Sigmund Bauman identified as liquid modernity. Now, Watson to my Sherlock. To elaborate, Hall and colleagues 2008 believed that the hope for increases in equality, opportunities, and freedoms promised by Britain and the United States during the 1960s and the 1970s had generally failed. Although, as they noted, there had made some progress, especially in racial and ethnic relationships. Emphasis on some. There were also discernible decreases in crime during the 1990s, some of which could be explained by the growth in mass incarceration, but even that did not generate much, if any, impact in various forms of violent crime. Thus, in many troubled localities blighted by permanent recession, unemployment, and burgeoning criminal markets, the murder rate is 6 times the national average, according to the research. To explain this paradox, Hall and Winlow argue that changes in the 1980s were not merely another structural adjustment of the economy and labor market. Instead, a radical change in the political economy and culture that allowed the market to exert an unprecedented domination of life. It is in this radically altered terrain in the 1980s that the most resounding phase of the crime explosion took place, and it presents new challenges for criminological theory. Early cultural criminology used the destabilizing conditions of late modernity to study how populations positioned themselves within these shifts, not least in the state's demand for more punishment and greater security. The enemy of early cultural criminology was the state and administrative criminology that advocated rational choice theory. As Holdsworth noted, for cultural criminology to go beyond its current, quote-unquote, coming of age, it needed to do more than to treat agents of control solely as negative forces. Culture and edgework should be studied with the same diligence, otherwise cultural criminology's political and intellectual impact was weakened. Overall, early cultural criminology sought to dissolve conventional understandings of crime regardless of whether they were specific theories of the institutionalized discipline of criminology itself. According to ROC 2017, cultural criminology today is left realism's successor, a conclusion that is up to debate. However, one of cultural criminology's major contributors, who published an update to cultural criminology in 2016, stated that perspective had moved beyond its coming of age and had been consolidating its position within the discipline. The update addressed criticisms of cultural criminology's inherent romanticism towards its objects of study, its failures to consider or incorporate broad gender dynamics in its analysis, and the charge that it was unable to formulate meaningful policy measures other than non-intervention. Hayward reaffirmed cultural criminology's commitment to studying a triadic framework of topics that included the construction of the phenomenological meaning of crime and risk-taking, power and existential accounts of crime, and punishment and control. He rebuffed charges that cultural criminology was not political enough in its work and that it had abandoned structural analysis of capitalism in its master institutions, countering that between 2006 and 2016, cultural criminology had indeed given emphasis to late modernity. He pointed out that cultural criminology practitioners had analyzed crime across structures, both in the wide sweep of neoliberal capitalism and amid the most local of situations and common of individual transgression. He also reaffirmed that one of cultural criminology's primary concerns was the crime-media nexus. As to the criticism level at cultural criminology by Lev Realis, Roger Matthews, 2014, and others who said it was unwilling to formulate meaningful policy initiatives, Hayward argued that this was a claim rooted in a debate about methods of research. In terms of social scientific methods, Hayward recognized that it could be beneficial to cultural criminology to break down the barriers between quantitative and qualitative methodology. However, as to the criticism that early cultural criminology relied too heavily on ethnographies, he notes that more recent cultural criminology work has employed a range of research techniques, everything from documentary filmmaking to digital cartography, narrative criminology to ethnography. Going forward, methodologically, cultural criminology must, according to Hayward, recognize that it is not only facing a rapidly changing technological and scientific landscape, but it is also competing in a war of ideas against much vaulted but often deeply problematic alternative forms of knowledge production. This includes, but are not limited to, big data, behavioral economics, neurological psychology, and new discoveries in the field of epigenetics. Looking forward to, quote-unquote, new lines of travel that cultural criminology might usefully develop as it continues its journey of expansion and consolidation, Hayward focuses on the term resistance, the failure of cultural criminology to analyze state formations and state agents, contributions cultural criminology might make to gender in criminology, and the role of numbers in cultural criminology's contribution to policy issues. The issue with resistance, ranging from full-scale revolutions to repressive formal state-sponsored regulations, for example, is that it lacks definitional consensus in the use of key analytical components for identifying meaningful political resistance. Closely connected to the need to more fully develop the concept of resistance is the need to more fully analyze state formations and state agents. For example, Hayward argues that there is a need to be more cultural criminology lines of inquiry about the war, terrorism, and state crime. Such an analysis could draw together the macro influence of structure with more mid-level theories of subculture and learned transgression. This would, Hayward claims, allow for analysis of state crimes and mass killings could be neutralized by collective forces involved in human rights violations. Cultural criminology's focus on state agents would draw on sociology and military history literature on the sensations and emotions associated with war and combat. Given that feminist criminology and cultural criminology already have a history of conversing and co-evolving, a question of what might be possible for the two approaches going forward emerges now. Cultural criminology's past and present work on media and cultural studies could also allow it to examine how female offenders, as well as how various religions foster theistic violence on females. On the question of policy going forward, the focus is on the role numbers play within cultural criminology, a long-standing concern for some criminologists in the positivist tradition, who have often looked at ethnographies as lacking in scientific stature. According to Hayward's overview, however, cultural criminology has established record of using non-qualitative analysis. He cites as supporting evidence the perspective's interest in social spatial analysis and cartography crime mapping. Typically, Hayward states cultural criminology's interest in crime mapping has focused on how to make top-down crime maps more warm and thus better able to interpret and interpolate phenomena such as affect, fear, parafunctionality, and even the acoustic soundscape. In the future, spatial statistical methodologies might be useful for cultural criminologists' interest in unveiling crucial power relationships and alternative crime maps that could be linked together participant observations and other qualitative methods to produce counter-arguments to traditional. At this point, it can be said that cultural criminology has in some ways grown up. Yet, like the changes in other critical perspectives that offer predictions to do more in the future, its most recent changes in theory construction appear to somewhat lack in abstraction and philosophical sophistication. One of its major values is that it is highly heuristic. It allows for a wide range of themes to be pursued around the assertion that consumerism cultivates, especially among young people, new forms of subjectivity based around desire, individualism, hedonism, and impulsivity, which in many instances can find expression in transgressive and even criminal behavior, from gang activity to drug use, mugging to rioting. No other critical criminology perspective focuses so perceptively on neoliberal late capitalism and its emphasis on consumerism. Hayward and Smith, 2017, caution, however, that the crime consumerism nexus does not suggest that consumer cultural causes crime in a simplistic, direct cause and effect manner. Instead, it should be understood as an attempt to outline the striking convergence between novel forms of subjectivity propagated by consumerism and many of the things identified by criminology as constituting criminality. In 2013, it covered four main themes with two more added in 2017. Fast forward to today, a total of seven main themes comprise contemporary consumer culture. The last, combat criminology, was added as some of it, if not most of it, is consistent with cultural criminology's emphasis on resistance to state oppression. This is consistent with cultural criminology's emphasis on the complexity of the meaning of crime. Criminals and criminal subcultures may very likely give the same behavior an alternative meaning organized around elaborate conventions of appearance, vocabularies of motive, and stylized presentations of self. Off the record, the seven main themes are 1. Insatiability of desire and perpetual dissatisfaction. This feature of consumer culture is normalized and essential to its survival and actively cultivated by it. Its relevance for criminology is its flip side, a constant sense of unfulfillment, dissatisfaction, and disillusionment that might contribute to a perceived sense of consumer deficit that may be bridged by street robbery and shoplifting, mostly property crimes. 2. New forms of hyperstrain. The thinking here is reminiscent of Merton strain theory. However, the criminal behavior is qualitatively different. In a consumer culture, the response to strain is more expressive than instrumental because the deprivation is one of identity that can derive from possessing desired products. In other words, products have come to bestow identity on individuals. 3. Engagement with risk. This theme is about the tension created by consumer culture's emphasis on the desire for excitement and the mundane. An overly controlled modern society with its encroachment of surveillance and the boring drudgery of low-wage employment. Under these cultural conditions, individuals may engage in risk street fighting or graffiti to enhance their sense of self or a semblance of control in their lives. 4. Instant gratification and/or impulsivity. In addition to creating insatiability, consumer culture's bombardment of stimuli cultivates a desire for immediate rather than delayed gratification that fundamentally distorts our experience of temporality that is reduced to a series of pure and unrelated presents. Consumers' culture's constant emphasis on the buy now language of advertising is sustained by the massive expansion of our best friend, the credit card. 5. Infantilization and/or adultification of maturation. Newly added to consumer criminology of panoramic criminological imagination, work within this theme explores how consumerism as a cultural ethos contributes to two developments. First, it appreciates the nature of adulthood in the roles of responsibilities typically associated with stages of people's lives. And second, it encourages very young teenagers to engage in adult behavior such as sexual activity, drug use, and criminality. In other words, it cultivates young people to make adult decisions while also encouraging adults to act like children. Off the record, let's not confuse this with hypersexualization, which involves the attribution by the media or people of a sexual character to a product or behavior that has nothing intrinsically sexual about it. 6. We have green cultural criminology. Also recently included in consumer criminology interest, green cultural criminology exposes the exploitative ecological practices associated with the globalized consumerist way of life. Green criminology is often confused with environmental criminology, which focuses on criminal patterns within particular built environments. Lastly, we have convict cultural criminology. It is added because it examines how insights from those who personally experience coercive correctional conditions can enlighten both the nature of state oppression and resistance to it through more humanitarian means.